content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the December 15th, 2017 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week has in the foreground Michael Flynn is standing there with a stern look on his face. He's holding, it looks like a cannonball, some kind of a bomb. It's got a fuse and it's burning down. In the background is the White House, and a small Donald Trump is standing on the porch, the second story porch, shaking his fin and screaming. And there's dark clouds in the background. And the headline is, "Why Flynn Flipped. Could his testimony threaten Trump's presidency?" And with that, we'll go to the main stories, how they were covered. Flynn cooperating with Mueller investigation. What happened? The investigation into possible collusion between Russia and the Trump campaign during the election reached a dramatic turning point last week when former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI and said he was cooperating with Special Counsel Robert Mueller. Flynn admitted misleading investigators about two sets of phone calls he made to then Russia Ambassador Sergei Kislyak during the presidential transition in December. In the first exchange, the retired general asked that Russia delay or vote against a UN resolution condemning Israeli settlements as illegal. In the second, he urged the Kremlin not to react to new sanctions imposed by President Obama. Flynn, one of Trump's closest advisors during the campaign, said he consulted senior members of the transition team on both of the messages he delivered to Vladimir Putin's regime. News outlets identified these officials as Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law, and K.T. McFarland, who was with the president-elect at his Mar-a-Lago resort at the time. The president said he was very happy about Flynn's guilty plea, claiming it provided no evidence of Russian collusion, but later sent a tweet about Flynn's firing that may increase the president's vulnerability to an obstruction of justice charge. In a related development, a whistleblower told Congress that Flynn assured a former business associate on Inauguration Day that the Russian sanctions would soon be ripped up. What the editorial said. The media is hyperventilating over Flynn's cooperation deal, said the Wall Street Journal. But whether it's ominous for the Trump presidency depends on what Flynn is telling Mueller. What we know is that Flynn's conversations with Kislyak all took place after Trump won the election. There is nothing scandalous or even unusual about a presidential transition meeting with a foreign ambassador. The former three-star general may have more secrets to share, but let's wait for the evidence. Flynn was facing serious charges when he flipped, said the New York Times. He failed to disclose substantial payments from Russia and Turkey, and he and his son allegedly discussed a kidnapping plot on U.S. soil with Turkish officials. The only plausible reason Mueller offered him a plea on a single charge is that Flynn has valuable information to share, perhaps about Trump himself. The attempts by Trump aides to undermine Obama foreign policy on Russia may have been illegal, said the Los Angeles Times. The Logan Act prohibits private citizens from negotiating with a foreign government. As other Trump associates are indicted or take pleas, Trump needs to understand that if he interferes by sacking Mueller or pardoning his own associates, he will escalate calls for his impeachment and removal from office. What the columnist said. Flynn's contacts with Kislyak during the transition were inappropriate but not illegal, said Rich Lowry in the New York Post. The idea such contacts violate the Logan Act is a fevered fantasy. The last time anyone was indicted under the Logan Act was 1803. Indeed, set aside Flynn's lies to investigators, and it's not clear what's supposed to be the larger scandal here. The scandal is obvious, said Max Boot in foreignpolicy.com. Clearly, there was a quid pro quo between the Trump campaign and Russia. Vladimir Putin's regime would help Trump win the election in return for having painful U.S. sanctions lifted. At least 12 of the president's associates had contacts with Russians and have lied and lied and lied about them. Donald Trump Jr., the president's son, eagerly accepted an offer from a Kremlin emissary of dirt on Hillary Clinton and even communicated secretly with WikiLeaks, which published the Democratic campaign emails stolen by Russian hackers. Flynn knows what the president knew about all this, which is why his cooperation with Mueller is so devastating. Kushner is probably next in Mueller's crosshairs, said Richard Painter and Norman Eisen in the New York Times. Trump's son-in-law has already been questioned by Mueller's team, and if he didn't disclose that he directed Flynn to contact the Russians, he may face perjury charges. Donald Jr. is also in legal jeopardy. Flynn's plea deal is only the tip of the iceberg. And we'll go ahead and take a second main story here. Trump roils Middle East with Jerusalem declaration. What happened? U.S. embassies around the world were on heightened alert this week after President Trump formally recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and ordered the State Department to start preparations to relocate the U.S. embassy there from Tel Aviv, an inflammatory move that broke with decades of international consensus. Home to some of the holiest sites in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, Jerusalem is at the heart of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Israel considers the city its eternal and undivided capital, while Palestinians regard Arab-majority East Jerusalem as the capital of a future Palestinian state. Previous U.S. presidents have said that Jerusalem's status should be determined as part of an overall peace deal. But Trump, fulfilling a campaign pledge, said that recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital was nothing more or less than a recognition of reality. The president insisted that his announcement did not predetermine Israeli sovereignty over all of Jerusalem and declared his support for a two-state solution. Above all, he said, our greatest hope is for peace. While Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu praised Trump's courageous decision, Arab and European leaders reacted with fury and concern, warning it could spark a wave of violence. Palestinians burned effigies of Trump in the West Bank, and in Gaza, the Islamist group Hamas called for 3 days of rage. Trump's declaration came as his son-in-law and advisor, Jared Kushner, pursues a peace initiative reportedly crafted with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Palestinian diplomat Manuel Hassassein said Trump's declaration amounted to a kiss of death for that effort. What the columnist said, Trump's declaration simply adds fuel to the fire of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, said Jonah Shep in nymag.com. The unilateral move is as provocative as it is baffling. It could seriously destabilize the region and further damage U.S. standing in the Middle East without demanding anything of substance in return from Israel. Most significantly, Trump's decision to shunt Palestinian interests aside will scuttle any chance of his administration being seen as an honest broker in peace talks. All of these concerns are overwrought, said Michael Rubin in WashingtonExaminer.com. Israel's legislature is in Jerusalem. So, too, are most of its ministries and the residents of both the prime minister and president. For all intents and purposes, Jerusalem is already the true capital of Israel. Any prohibition on placing an embassy there is based more on a rejection of the idea of Israel as a normal state than on any legal and practical reasoning. But why take this risky yet largely symbolic step now, asks Daniel Larrison in the AmericanConservative.com. Perhaps Trump was motivated by his long-running instinct to shake things up, or his desire to do the opposite of former President Obama, who many thought was too tough on Israel. More likely, with his approval rating slumping, Trump acted out of his insatiable desire for praise and flattery. Trump has made one of the most potentially costly Middle East blunders in decades, simply so the hardline evangelicals and right-wing pro-Israel activists that are part of his base will congratulate him. And now the controversy of the week. Trump, can the president obstruct justice? Did President Trump just admit to obstruction of justice, asks Andrew Prokop in Vox.com. After Michael Flynn, Trump's former national security advisor, pleaded guilty last week to lying to the FBI, Trump couldn't resist trying to downplay the bombshell news in a tweet. Flynn, quote, had nothing to hide, end quote, Trump tweeted, but had to be fired, quote, because he lied to the vice president and the FBI, end quote. That was a huge legal error. If Trump knew Flynn had lied to the FBI, a felony, when he fired him back in February, then Trump's subsequent efforts to make then-FBI Director James Comey drop his investigation of Flynn and Trump's eventual firing of Comey could constitute criminal obstruction of justice. Recognizing the mistake, Trump's lawyer John Dowd quickly claimed he himself had written the incriminating tweet. That's not very credible, said the New York Times in an editorial. Even more dubious is Dowd's subsequent insistence that the president cannot obstruct justice because he is the chief law enforcement officer. It's an embarrassing and unpersuasive argument, but expect to hear it more. Given the overwhelming evidence that Trump tried to shut down the probe of his ties to Russia, his panicked defenders simply have nothing else to work with. Actually, Dowd is right, said Andrew McCarthy in NationalReview.com. Under our system of government, both the FBI and the Justice Department are subordinates of the president, delegated to exercise his power, not their own. Trump has unfettered authority to shut down investigations or fire FBI chiefs as he sees fit. His motive in firing Flynn and Comey doesn't matter, said Alan Dershowitz in Slate.com. The president cannot be charged with obstruction simply for firing somebody he's authorized to fire, or for exercising any of the other powers explicitly granted to him by the Constitution. Could Congress nonetheless decide to impeach Trump if Special Counselor Robert Mueller concludes the president committed obstruction? Yes. Impeachment is part of our system of checks and balances with looser criteria than criminal statutes. Let's focus on impeachment, then, and on history, said Daniel Hamill in Slate.com. The articles of impeachment drawn up against Richard Nixon and Bill Clinton both included a charge of obstruction of justice. During Clinton's impeachment, many current Republican leaders, among them Senator Mitch McConnell and Attorney General Jeff Sessions, were adamant that a president who obstructed an investigation had to be removed from office. Trump's lawyers are already trying to head off impeachment, said Renato Mariotti in TheHill.com, which is why they're hoping to convince congressional Republicans that Trump can't obstruct justice. but that's transparently absurd. If a president could fire anyone in law enforcement who investigated him without penalty, he would be above the law, and we'd effectively be living in an autocracy. Maybe that's where we're headed, said Dahlia Lithwick in Slate.com. As Trump further erodes the norms and institutions vital to our democracy with every passing day, Republicans have made it clear that they've no interest in holding this president accountable for his lies, his threats against political enemies, his incompetence, or his openly performed corruption. It may already be too late to slide toward authoritarianism for fellow Republicans to impeach him for an abstract crime like obstruction of justice. Even if Mueller presents smoking gun evidence that Trump and his aides cut an illegal deal with Russia, it might not bring the Trump train to a stop. Trump's base and his enablers in Congress will simply dismiss Mueller's findings as more hashtag fake news. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week segment. Seems it was a good week for live theater after a New York performance of Cats was disrupted when an audience member's service dog got away and began chasing one of the cat-costumed actors. This is the first time one of the actual cats was involved in an incident with a dog, said a theater spokesperson. It was a good week for Taiwan when a vivid rainbow appeared over the city of Taipei and lingered for a jaw-dropping 9 hours, 3 hours longer than the previous world record set in Yorkshire, England. And it was a good week for evacuation procedures when the toilets filled up on a Delta flight from New York to Seattle, forcing the pilot to make an emergency landing in Billings, Montana, to let the passengers find relief of built-up pressures, as the airline put it. But it was a bad week for abominable snowmen when the most rigorous analysis to date of the purported Yeti DNA from Nepal and Tibet found that the remains came from bears and a dog. It was a bad week for privilege after Prince Laurent, age 54, the black sheep of the Belgian royal family, complained that a proposed 10% cut to his allowance of $370,000 would constitute an attack on the most fundamental human rights in a developed society. And finally, it was a bad week for protesting too much after a British study found that 74% of young folks from 16 to 24 think the label Snowflake Generation may negatively impact their mental health. While we are here, a boring important note. SCOTUS, S-C-O-T-U-S, lets travel ban take effect. The Supreme Court this week allowed the Trump administration's revised travel ban to take effect. Pending the results of legal challenges against it in lower courts. The third version of the ban is issued in September, affects the citizens of 8 nations, 6 of them predominantly Muslim. The details vary by country, but the executive order bars most citizens from Iran, Libya, Syria, Yemen, Somalia, Chad, and North Korea from entering the U.S., as well as some groups from Venezuela. Federal judges in Hawaii and Maryland had partially blocked parts of the latest ban from taking effect amid ongoing litigation. Judges on the Fourth and Ninth Circuit Courts of Appeals are set to hear arguments on those injunctions this week. And before we go on, I just have to point out I didn't realize the acronym SCOTUS stands for the Supreme Court of the United States. Moving on to the briefing page, the catastrophe in Yemen. A Saudi Arabian blockade has left millions of civilians starving and without fuel or clean water. What is this conflict about? What's happening? Yemen is in the midst of a massive humanitarian crisis. It was already the poorest country in the Middle East before a Sunni-Shiite civil war tore the nation into two dysfunctional halves, and 2 years of massive bombing by a Saudi-led Arab coalition have destroyed hospitals, schools, factories, and mosques, and reduced parts of many cities to rubble. The destruction of water treatment plants and sewage systems has caused the worst cholera outbreak in modern history, with nearly a million people infected and thousands dead. With Yemen importing 90% of its food, most people there were malnourished even before the Saudis imposed a blockade last month in response to a rebel missile fired at the Saudi capital, Riyadh. Now both food and fuel are unaffordable, clean water is scarce, and the hospitals that remain open are full of skeletal children and sick adults. If the blockade isn't fully lifted soon, says UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs Mark Lowcock, Yemen will face the largest famine the world has seen for many decades, with millions of victims. How did the war start? It's a result of the Arab Spring. Yemenis seeking more say in their government ousted their president, Ali Abdullah Saleh, in 2012, and started drawing up a new constitution. But the Houthis, a Shiite minority group based in the north, rejected it as unfair. In 2015, allied with troops loyal to their former enemy Saleh, they attacked and chased new president Abed Rabo Mansour Hadi out of the capital, Sana'a. He turned to Saudi Arabia for aid. The Saudis already distrusted Yemen because of its democratic leanings and large, heavily armed population of 28 million, and the threat of a hostile Shiite power on their southern border was too much to bear. Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman did not commit many ground troops, instead choosing to bombard cities with cluster bombs and choke off Houthi supplies by blocking airports and seaports. More than 10,000 civilians have been killed and some 50,000 wounded as Saudi airstrikes have hit hospitals, schools, and even weddings and funerals. Amnesty International has accused the coalition of deliberately targeting civilians. Who else is involved? The Saudi coalition of Sunni Muslim states includes the UAE, Egypt, Morocco, Jordan, Sudan, Kuwait, Qatar, and Bahrain. They are assisted by southern Yemeni militias, some of the Yemeni army based in Aden, and Islamist extremist groups. The Houthis, on the other hand, have been supplied with missiles and other weapons by Iran. The rebels are not a true Iranian proxy like Hezbollah in Syria or Shiite militias in Iraq. The Houthis' version of Shiite Islam is very different from Iran's, but Iran's leaders are egging on the conflict to cause problems for their Saudi rivals. Meanwhile, the war is in a stalemate, with the Saudi-backed Hadi faction controlling the south, and the Houthis dug into their strongholds in the north. This week, Houthi rebels deepened the conflict by killing former President Saleh after he made reconciliation overtures to the Saudis. What is the U.S.'s role? The U.S. is the biggest supplier of weapons to Saudi Arabia, with sales of planes, tanks, and bombs surging under President Obama, and continuing under President Trump. At the beginning of the Yemeni conflict in 2015 and 2016, U.S. forces directly assisted the Saudi-led coalition in targeting the Houthi rebels. The Pentagon says it no longer provides that aid, but since Trump took office, it has doubled its refueling assistance, operating gas stations in the sky that allow Saudi planes to refuel in flight for their bombing sorties. In November, in a rare rebuke, Congress passed a non-binding resolution saying that U.S. military assistance to Saudi Arabia for its war in Yemen has not been authorized by Congress and is not included under use of force laws passed in 2001 and 2002. It said the Pentagon must restrict its activities to combating Yemen's branch of al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups in Yemen are growing as they recruit angry, desperate Yemenis. Is there hope of a truce? Not much. President Trump enthusiastically praised the Saudis' strong action against the Houthis on his visit to Riyadh in May. He offered them another $110 billion in weapons. The U.S. and U.K., which also sold the Saudis more than $1 billion worth of arms this year, have blocked significant international intervention to halt the war. And while the U.N. has held three rounds of peace talks, they went nowhere. Humanitarian groups are now begging Saudi Arabia to lift the blockade. "We are far beyond the need to raise an alarm," said Paolo Cernucci of the International Rescue Committee. "What is happening now is a complete disgrace." And we'll read a few of the columns. The first from Katie Rogers at the New York Times. Her column is titled, "How Abusers Shaped the News." For decades, journalists Matt Lauer, Charlie Rose, Bill O'Reilly, and Mark Halperin tried to help Americans understand the country, said Katie Rogers. Now that those powerful media figures have been felled by their sexual abuse of women, you have to wonder how their misogyny shaped their storytelling. When Lauer interviewed Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump during the campaign, he went easy on Trump while ambushing Clinton with a barrage of hostile questions about her private email server. Lauer's defenders argued Clinton deserved tougher questions because she was the presumed frontrunner. But now we know how Lauer treats women in private. That interview reads differently. It's the same with Halperin. When more than 12 women accused Trump of sexual assault last year, the veteran political journalist questioned their credibility and insisted the Republican candidate had done nothing illegal. In a book he co-authored about the 2008 election, Halperin described Clinton as Napoleon in a Navy pantsuit. In retrospect, it's easy to see the contempt Lauer, Halperin, O'Reilly, et al. Felt for ambitious feminists. As media gatekeepers, they help shape what the public sees, consumes, and ultimately feels. This comes from Ireland. Susan McKay at the Irish Times. Brexit reopens old wounds. Things are getting tense on the border between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland, said Susan McKay. The island wears this border like a noose around its neck, and Brexit is tightening the rope. When the UK leaves the European Union, it will take Northern Ireland with it. We will have to show passports and pay customs duties to cross back and forth between the Republic, which will remain in the EU. And the North? Nobody knows, but already distrust is on the rise. Decades of neglect left towns in ruins on both sides of the border. And now old animosities are being rehearsed as strangers trade insults on social media. In the North, bickering unionists and nationalists can't form a government. In the Republic, anti-British sentiment is rising. Mullaghmore, near the border on the Republic side, is where the IRA murdered British naval commander Lord Mountbatten and four others in 1979. When Prince Charles paid a visit there a couple of years ago, he was warmly welcomed. But on a sign put up to mark the visit, which featured a smiling photo of the prince, the face of Charles has recently been gouged out. Many in Ireland remember a militarized border with checkpoints, soldiers, and red torches signaling you to stop in the darkness. Is it coming back? And this from Russia, dropping the democratic facade. So much for pretending that Russia is a democracy, said Mikhail Rostovsky, with an apparently innocent remark about Japan to reporters last week. Russian First Deputy Prime Minister Igor Shuvalov has destroyed the myth, which was on its last legs anyway, that Russia will have a competitive presidential election. Shuvalov said that President Vladimir Putin has a summit planned with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe for next May. Notice anything amiss? A presidential election is scheduled for next spring, and the new president will be inaugurated in May, just after the summit. Surely Abe would see no point in meeting with a lame duck, so the implication is clear. You can vote for whom you like, but Putin's successor in the post of Russian president will still be Putin himself. Of course, that's clear to all anyway, since just a few months out, nobody serious is running against Putin, who hasn't yet bothered to declare. And there is no trace of any real campaign. In this country where the powers of the head of state do not in fact differ much from the powers of an autocratic monarch, a presidential election should be a massive event. Instead, Russians get the modern equivalent of the lazy showing of hands at a solemn political event during the Brezhnev era. It's time for our in-depth feature called The Last Word. This week, the title is When the End Comes. My father scheduled his own death so that he could say proper goodbyes, says writer Karen Brown. He kept his sense of humor to the end and showed us how to let go with dignity, grace, and love. How about Tuesday? My father is propped up on three pillows in bed, talking logistics with my sister and me. We've just brought him his Ovaltine and insulin. Or would Thursday be better? That's a couple of days after the kids are done with camp. Okay, let's plan on Thursday. My father is scheduling his death, sort of. He's deciding when to stop going to dialysis. That starts the bodily clock that will lead to his falling into sleep more and more often, and then into a coma and eventually nothingness. He is remarkably sanguine about the prospect, which we've all had a long time to consider. A master of understatement, he promises it's not a terribly hard decision to stop treatment and let nature take its course. But it is a bit irreversible. If I'm honest, he's ready now to stop dialysis. It's a brutal routine for someone in his condition, incredibly weak and fragile from living with end-stage pancreatic cancer, kidney disease, and diabetes. It's painful for him to hold his head and neck up, which he has to do to get to the dialysis center. During the procedure, he must be closely watched so his blood pressure doesn't plummet. But he's always been a generous man. He's willing to sacrifice his own comfort in his dying days for the convenience of his family, since we all want to be present at the end. If he pushes his last day of dialysis to Tuesday, then my sister can still go on the California vacation she'd been planning with her family. If he pushes it to Thursday, I can still take the journalism fellowship I'd accepted. It will also give his grandchildren time to finish up their summer jobs and fly down. As it happens, though, when Thursday comes, he just can't get out of the house. He is practically crying from discomfort as the caretaker lifts him off the bed onto the rolling walker to start the journey up the stair lift and into the car. I tell him it's okay. He can get back in bed. He looks so relieved when we rest his head back on the pillows. I cancel my Amtrak ticket home to Western Massachusetts and tell my husband not to expect me for the rest of the month. A day later, my father is sipping his coffee in bed, the dog at his feet. He eats almost nothing, but he can usually get down a mug of hot milky drink. He looks at his bookcase, the one he's been ignoring for years, as he wrote his professional tome on decision theory. All these delicious books I've been saving for my private delectation, and I'll never get to read. I suggest we find a book to read aloud to him over the next few weeks. We choose As I Lay Dying by William Faulkner, because even if he doesn't always follow the story, the words are nice to listen to. And you can't find a more appropriate title than that. Later, I'm at the kitchen table trying to figure out which insulin pen hasn't yet reached its expiration date. And I'm eavesdropping on my parents through the baby monitor. We tried different methods of communication and nothing worked very well. My father's room is on the ground floor and most of the house's activity is a floor above. He would try clanking the metal bar above his hospital bed with a spoon, but it wasn't loud enough, and he'd be exhausted by the time someone noticed. We finally realized the best method was the same one we use for infants. That way, when he talks or moans or coughs, we hear it on the next floor. Of course, he forgets that any conversation he has on the phone with a visitor is heard by whoever has the other device. We probably should turn it off, but then we might forget to turn it back on. Plus, it's awfully tempting to listen in on deathbed conversations, which is how I find myself listening to my parents talk, for the first time in a long time, about life, death, and marriage. My mother doesn't like going down to the bottom floor. She says it's hard on her legs, plus it's too musty and a little sad, but now she has no choice. How will you fare after I'm gone? Dad asks. They are not a terribly affectionate couple, not in the last few decades. She tends to be irritable. He can get defensive. She likes cruises and TV entertainment news. He likes to read and write and think deeply about his profession. But they are still attached to each other. Well, I've gotten used to you being gone, in a way, she says. For the last 20 years, you've been working on your book. I've had to find other things to do. That must have been frustrating. Yes, it was. Or, I feel sort of guilty, but I've booked a cruise, Mom says, for September. Why would you feel guilty? Because I'm assuming I won't need to be at home anymore. It just feels like I'm counting on you being gone. Well, that's a perfectly safe bet. I'm glad you're going. Then quiet. I finally turn off the monitor. The next evening, after I prick Dad's nearly bloodless finger with his glucose monitor, I crawl into the bed next to him. The Great British Baking Show is on mute. He puts his bone-thin arm around me and squeezes with a surprising amount of strength. "We have just enough plumpness between the two of us for a good cuddle," he says. "Are you insulting me, Dad?" "Oh, did I promise not to?" We both chuckle. Looking around, it's clear his room is starting to empty out. For the past year, my teenage son has taken one or two items of his grandfather's clothing home every time he visits. A tracksuit, his favorite Hawaiian shirt. My mother gets frustrated. "I bought those for Rex, and he hardly has any clothes left." But Dad loves Sam wearing his clothes. Dad's tchotchkes are a bigger challenge to give away. He has awful taste in souvenirs. There's an oversized green wine glass that says, "Sexy bitch." I once asked why he had it in his room. "Because I couldn't think of anyone to give it to." But there's his treasure drawer, an oak toilet paper holder, a shell necklace he bought in a cruise ship gift shop, a beeswax candle. He wants to make sure no one fights over his stuff. I assure him that will not be a problem. He also warns me, somewhat sheepishly, that there's a box in the closet of, let's say, erotic literature. "What do you think Goodwill does with that sort of thing?" he says. We will not be donating that box to Goodwill. My youngest sister is sleeping in the extra bed, jet-lagged. She's just come from California to help. My dad wakes up when I enter the room, carrying his milky coffee. The sliding glass door is slightly open to let fresh air in. It's the morning before I leave on a 4-day work trip. I feel conflicted about going, and there's a chance he may not be around when I return. But after a few emergency phone sessions with my therapist, emotionally panicked texts to friends, and assurance from my father himself, "I would hate for you to miss a professional opportunity," I decide to go. But first, our morning routine. Take blood sugar, give pills, try to get down some prune juice. "Would you like me to read some more Faulkner?" "No, thank you. I'm just letting my mind free associate." And then, "I like listening to the birds." Dad waited for me to return from my trip. Then he waited for my children to arrive for the weekend. He even waited for my husband to order new guitar strings from Amazon. He wanted to serenade Dad one last time. On his last good morning, he exhales slowly and asks me to hack into his email account. I help him write farewell notes to doctors, old colleagues, former girlfriends. He dictates as I type his words and click send. He wants to let them know he's near the end and how much they've meant to him. Some reply immediately with sweet messages, hoping to call. Other emails are returned by daughters or husbands, letting us know that the friend, colleague, ex-lover is actually doing more poorly than Dad. His best friend from childhood died just a month earlier, but before he did, as narrated by his daughter, he cracked one more one-liner to my dad. "Looks like I've won our race to the pearly gates." My dad's reply, "But only just." Long ago, tennis partner Vince calls to tell him two jokes. I only hear Dad's side, which is a surprisingly hearty laugh at the end of each one. Then he tells one back. A married couple go to the doctor, and the wife says, "Doctor, my husband won't talk to me." The doctor turns to the husband and says, "Sir, is that true?" And the man replies, "Well, I don't like to interrupt." I almost missed my father's last breath because I was making nachos in the kitchen. One of my sisters called out, panicked from the bottom of the stairs, "Karen, come now." Gathered around his bed were my mother, my brother-in-law, my two younger sisters, and the hospice nurse, a petite spark plug of a woman whom we had met an hour earlier. Her thick Polish accent had the comforting, confident lilt of someone who understood death. We'd been on bedside vigil since early hours of the morning, which came after an unusually bad night of pain. If I were to resent any part of his otherwise dignified death, it would be those hours. When I was little, I used to get bad colic, intense stomach aches, and my dad would stay up with me in the bathroom as long as it took, his warm hand on my belly, and tell me, "I wish I could take the pain for you." So when I was sitting at his bedside some 40 years later, the roles reversed. I recounted their memory and said aloud, I guess this is you taking my pain. I'm not sure that gave him much of a reprieve. My sister and I held hands all night. After two emergency visits from the 24-hour palliative nurses, we hit upon the right dose of painkiller and he was able to rest. I had been so focused on getting him relief that I didn't quite realize the trade-off, that he would start to leave us for good in a morphine haze, that I wouldn't get a last conversation, at least not one that I could schedule or choreograph. We did get last words, though, before the morphine. He had looked at my sister and me, full of love and trust, and said, "I'm in your hands." Over the next 8 or 9 hours, as he breathed quickly and loudly, eyes slightly open but looking peaceful, at ease, please let that be so, we were told by the steady train of hospice nurses that his time was almost up. We told our children, our half-sister in Australia, his sister in England, and several dear friends, that he would likely not wake up and it was time to say goodbye, even if just in our minds. Those of us present each took a few moments at his side, whispering in his ear. Could he hear us? They say at some level he probably could. We left him with as much love and affection as words to an unconscious man could convey. He'd always had a hair-trigger crying reflex, from Hallmark commercials on up, and if he'd have been awake, he would have been bawling. Why I thought that was a good time for a snack, who knows? My sister's holler from downstairs came about 5 p.m., I abandoned an open bag of tortilla chips on the kitchen table and had just enough time to join the circle around the bed. His chest started to rise and fall at a slower and slower pace until the movement was imperceptible, and then not at all. The nurse took out her stethoscope, put it to his chest, and said, "I'm so sorry." It's funny what people want to take of the dead, to keep the memories living. A few days later, we took turns both throwing away trash and claiming it. One sister wanted his last uneaten Cadbury's fruit and nut bar. My other sister wanted an old Cambridge University t-shirt with stains on it. He was always spilling. And I wanted, of course, the green wine glass that said, "Sexy bitch." This was excerpted from an essay that was originally published in longreads.com. Read one of the obituaries for you this week. The actor who played TV's most lovable klutz, Jim Nabors, 1930 to 2017. For a generation of Americans, Jim Nabors will always be linked with the lovable country bumpkin Gomer Pyle. Neighbors first played the role on TV's The Andy Griffith Show in 1962. With Pyle a bumbling but sweet-natured gas station attendant in the fictional town of Mayberry, North Carolina. Viewers ate up Neighbors and his Alabama twang, and Pyle-isms like golly and shazam becoming inescapable catchphrases. The character proved so popular that 2 years later, CBS decided to make Gomer Pyle, USMC, in which Pyle travels to California to become a U.S. Marine. In its 5 seasons, the show never dropped out of the top 10 in ratings. Neighbors was just as charmed by Gomer Pyle as audiences were. If you had to play a character, I probably played the nicest character of all, he said. Being Gomer could bring you up from your toes. Born in the small town of Sylacauga, Alabama, the musically gifted Neighbors sang in his school glee club and church choir and played the clarinet in the school band, said the New York Times. He briefly worked as a typist in New York City while trying unsuccessfully to break into a stage career, and in the late 1950s moved to Los Angeles to help relieve his chronic asthma. Neighbors had never acted before when Andy Griffith caught him singing at a Santa Monica nightclub, said the Washington Post. For his act, Neighbors portrayed a bumpkin whose high-pitched drawl changed to an operatic baritone when he broke into song. Griffith loved it. "I don't know what you do," he told Neighbors, "but it's magic, whatever it is." Neighbors' run on the Andy Griffith Show culminated in the 4th season finale, which saw Pyle join the Marines. Gomer Pyle, USMC, provided viewers with an escape during the turbulent 1960s, with the show avoiding hot-button issues like the Vietnam War, said the Los Angeles Times. The military, in turn, embraced Gomer Pyle as a sort of mascot, with Neighbors performing before an audience of 40,000 cheering Marines in Vietnam in 1971. After Gomer Pyle went off the air, Neighbors returned to his musical roots, recording more than 30 albums in genres including country and opera, while hosting and appearing on variety shows. "There's something so joyous about music," he said. "Acting pales in comparison." We're on the Talking Points page now with an article titled GOP Tax Bill. This Isn't Populism. Donald Trump ran for president promising to save the struggling middle class, said E.J. Dionne in the Washington Post. But that populist mask has slipped, revealing another trickle-down Republican whose loyalty is to corporations, business owners like himself, and the wealthiest Americans. Last week, with Trump's full-throated support, Senate Republicans rammed through one of the most scandalous special interest tax bills in history, a Christmas present for the GOP's corporate and individual donors. Republicans must now reconcile the Senate bill with a slightly different House version, but the centerpiece of both plans is a dramatic reduction in the corporate tax rate from 35% to 20%. Major tax cuts for pass-through businesses like Trump's, and an estate tax rollbacks enabling the country's wealthiest individuals to pass more tax-free money to their heirs. How do Republicans fund the $6 trillion in taxes they cut over 10 years, asked Jordan Weissman in Slate.com? By imposing a $4.5 trillion tax increase on various groups of mostly middle-class Americans. This tax overhaul will deepen inequality while rewarding the same people and companies who have been winning the U.S. economy for decades. "Don't be misled by Democrats' outrageous and bogus claims," said Brian Riedel in NationalReview.com. "This legislation does not represent a middle-class tax hike. The Senate's plan doubles the standard deduction, and the Nonpartisan Tax Policy Center calculates that it would give 75% of all families an average cut of $850 a year. Just 12%, mostly upper middle class homeowners who currently itemize lots of deductions would see an increase. Thanks to obscure budget rules, those cuts are due to expire in 2025, though it would be political insanity for lawmakers not to extend them. Even if they didn't, the typical middle-income family would receive a cumulative $7,000 tax cut in the early years, followed by a roughly $100 annual tax increase later. Still a good deal. Spend the numbers all you want. This tax bill sure isn't for the forgotten voters Trump claimed to care about, said Paul Waldman in the Washington Post. Senators Chuck Grassley and Orrin Hatch gave the game away last week when they made two ugly but revealing comments. Grassley defended the bill's weakening of the estate tax on the 0.2% of wealthiest Americans by saying that rich people invest their money as opposed to those who are just spending every darn penny they have, whether on booze or women or movies. Hatch, for his part, said it makes sense to cut corporate taxes and reduce Obamacare and other safety net spending, since the government currently spends trillions to help people who won't help themselves. Those statements laid bare the ideological belief at the heart of the Republican tax effort. Rich people are more virtuous, even if they inherited their wealth, and therefore deserve to be taxed as lightly as possible, while being poor reflects a moral failing. The economy may or may not benefit, said Kevin Williamson, but Congress and the Republicans certainly won't. The frantic passage of this absurdly complex legislation was an absolute disgrace. Congress's downward spiral began with Obamacare, which Democrats rammed through along party lines, but Republicans sank even lower when they passed this major tax overhaul in the dead of the night with no public hearings and zero Democratic input, even adding handwritten amendments that lawmakers didn't have time to read before the vote. That leaves us just time for a quick quote from Tina Fey, who says, "Say yes, and you'll figure it out afterward." We have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it, and be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.